Accession number 28642, Reel 5.
Third tape interview. This is the third tape interview with Max Sheen in his home in Perth, Western Australia. On the 30th of the 9th, 2005, for the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. Max, before you were telling us a little bit about how the Royal Navy was improving its methods of finding submarines and that the score was improving as time went by, how were the German submarines countering this improvement on your behalf?
Well, the German submarines were, at the time I joined Bluebell, were just getting their act together with this wolf pack technique, where they would deport themselves across the Atlantic in a line, almost within sight of each other, and hope to intercept convoys crossing the line. When one U-boat would sight a convoy, it would call BDU, which is in Germany the submarine headquarters, and report the convoy position, course and speed, and then the BDU would in turn radio all U-boats, giving them a position of the convoy and telling them, those that were in range, to concentrate on this convoy. Thereafter, from our point of view, we knew this was going on because Admiralty would send a signal saying, your convoy has been reported, and probably the next day we get a signal saying, there are now three U-boats shadowing your convoy, and the next day, typically, there are now nine U-boats shadowing your convoy, expect attack tonight. And we would get an attack that night. So this shows how both sides are working. The Germans were concentrating on each convoy they found, but in doing so, they had to make signals. And the signals could be DF, that's direction found, because every ship, including Bluebell, had what they called HFDF. That's high frequency direction finding, or HUF, DUF, as it's called. And this is a triangular assembly up on the bridge, and the telegraphists, when they received any German message, they wouldn't be able to decode it, but they would report to Admiralty the type of message and its bearing and our position. And Admiralty collated all of these reports and were able to plot most U-boats. In fact, they made it their aim to plot every U-boat every day. They didn't always do it, but by having this aim, they got very close to it. Now, this didn't require any breaking of codes, but at the same time, of course, they were working hard at breaking the codes. This is going on at Bletchley Park in England, and sometimes they would succeed, and then we'd get probably a bit more information, but we got all we needed. That is, advice as to when a convoy is likely to be attacked. Now, on our part, what would happen is that as soon as nautical twilight finished, that is, as soon as it became really dark, the convoy would alter course. And we hoped that the U-boats didn't know this, and we might shake them off. Sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't. But otherwise, our technique was to, at that night, close in on the convoy, keep about half a mile or a mile away. Each escort vessel had its own position, and ours was usually starboard side forward of the convoy. We were just level with the front line of ships to starboard, and we'd zigzag in and out of the convoy all night. When daylight came, we would then open out to the limit of visibility, hoping to trap U-boats that were trying to overcome the convoy. But we normally get attacked well after sunset, when the U-boats, having shadowed the convoy all day, would be ahead of the convoy, and then they would let the convoy overtake them. Of course, all this was surmise. It wasn't until after the war that we got confirmation that this is what they were doing. But the first we would know sometimes would be when a ship would be torpedoed, and then we'd await orders, we were searching all the time with ASDIC and with radar when we got it. And sometimes an escort vessel would contact a submarine before it made an attack. Then it would attack immediately, and while it was attacking, the convoy would carry on and the ship would eventually be left behind. Now, mostly the senior officer would detail off the fast ships, if we had them, to take on the attack on the U-boat, and the corvette, or a corvette that found it, would resume its station. The policy was that we slow ships, our main aim was to get the ships of the convoy into harbour. The second aim was to sink U-boats, but the first aim had priority. And so when a U-boat was detected by a corvette, it usually finished up that perhaps a destroyer or two and a sloop would concentrate on that U-boat, leave the convoy, and we'd return to the convoy. And that seemed to work pretty well. Now, other aspects of defence from our point of view, because we didn't know everything the U-boats were doing, we knew what we were doing, was that air cover was most important. If we could have an aircraft from Coastal Command circling the convoy all day, that would be a great advantage, because while they didn't always sink U-boats, although often they did, they would cause the U-boats to submerge, which meant they would reduce their speed from 17 knots on the surface to about 4 or 5 knots submerged, and then the convoy could leave them behind. So that was a great advantage to have a Coastal Command. I think I mentioned on the earlier interview session that we did have other aircraft available. Some were mounted on merchant ships, on catapults, and later on the escort carriers started to come into play. The first one was Empire Audacity. It became HMS Audacity, and I mentioned her before, and it was a great value. Now, as the war went on, particularly after America came in, more and more of these escort carriers became available, and they had great success. And with an escort carrier, of course, you have air cover all the time. Depending on Coastal Command, you only have it while we were within range of a land-based airfield. But we didn't. I've learned more about this since the war, when everything is published, and you can read all about what was happening in your own convoy. At the time, we only knew certain things. The development of radar was a big advantage, particularly radar in aircraft. I think 10-centimetre radar was a great British invention. We had it in Vibel, and aircraft had it too.
What was this sort of radar?
10-centimetre.
Can you describe that to us?
Well, all I know about it is that is the wavelength of the frequency on which they operated. We talk about wavelength or frequency. The product of these two was the speed of light. I can't remember what the frequency was. It didn't worry us. We had the set, and we just operated it. But when this 10-centimetre radar was fitted to aircraft, especially Coastal Command, they could fly around and watch the radar and pick up a U-boat and attack without the U-boat knowing really it had been detected, because this would go on at night. And particularly as they also fitted searchlights onto the aircraft, they called lay lights. And when an aircraft picked up a U-boat on radar, she would dive toward it, and the last moment switch on the light, see the U-boat and bomb it. And this was a very effective means of attack, because the German countermeasure was to put in detection devices that would tell them when the British 10-centimetre radar had picked them up. And the whole time these measures and countermeasures were coming into play on both sides. We didn't know too much about what the U-boat was doing in that respect. All we knew is that when Admiralty said they were about to attack, they did.
In relation to U-boats, in relation to their early success, how close a thing was it that the U-boats would win the day, as it were?
It became very close indeed. because some of our convoys, we lost ships without any kills of U-boats. Of course, if you go on like this, you're going to lose the war. We're losing ships, and Germany aren't losing U-boats. But with the various improvements in convoy procedure, we gradually overcame this, until by May 1943, by which time I'd left Bluebell. But by that time, the British and Allied countermeasures were so efficient that the score came to be one ship sunk, one U-boat sunk. And at that, it became uneconomic for the Germans to persevere. And so from that time, Dönitz ordered U-boats not to attack Allied defended convoys. So he had to pick his targets out of the way.
Well, we could talk about the result when the Americans were to join in the war following Japanese entry. But can we talk a little bit about what the other side of your wartime life was like? What was Gibraltar like, for instance, on leave when you reached Gibraltar?
Well, Gibraltar had many advantages for us. For one thing, it's nearer the equator than Britain, so the weather there is warmer, and we enjoyed that very much. Swimming was pretty popular in Gibraltar. When we berthed on the generally there's a ring of berths around Gibraltar, and there's a couple of entrances. Where we were berthed was on the outer part of this, now facing Algeciras Bay. On an afternoon, making men, we would leave Bluebell, walk around to the rock, and there's a tunnel under the rock. And we walk through the tunnel and come out on the Mediterranean side and go swimming there. And that was very pleasant. And it was the first experience I had of swimming from a shingle beach. And the waves on the beach rattle these little stones, and you can feel a sort of a vibration in the back of your neck while you're swimming. But it was very pleasant indeed. When we weren't swimming, we'd go for a walk through Gibraltar shopping centre, and that was very good too, because the shops were better stocked than the shops in England, although it was mainly with British produce that they had, and that was enjoyable. A lot of people did a lot of drinking in Gibraltar. I was never a heavy drinker, and I don't think we drank ashore. We'd come back aboard the ship and probably have a beer with dinner or something like that. But one time, one of the other officers in Bluebell, Wilfred Stiff was his name, he had joined just before I did. We applied to the Spanish government for a visa to walk across the neck of Gibraltar to La Linea, which is a town nearby. It took us, we had to apply on one convoy, and when we returned after two more convoys, we picked up our visa and we walked across and had a bit of shopping in La Linea. We didn't really buy very much. I thought La Linea was not a first-rate town, but one thing that did impress us is in the window of a bookshop, there was a book by Preen, who was the fellow who sank the Royal Oak, and obviously they were sympathetic to the Nazis at that stage, so we didn't feel as though we really wanted. La Linea had a bull ring. We never went to a bullfight. I don't agree with bullfights, but that's the sort of place it was. But aboard Bluebell, I was wine caterer. Generally, the junior officer on board looked after the wines for the wardroom. And in England, we could take aboard beer and whiskey and gin. In Gibraltar, we could take on wines from Spain. And we dealt with the British wine supplier called Saccone and Speed, and they had a very convenient arrangement whereby in Liverpool we'd take aboard quite a lot of beer, as much as we could store away, and we didn't pay for it until we drank it. So it belonged to Saccone and Speed and until we consumed it. When we got to Gibraltar, there were ships based on Gibraltar that had run short of beer, so we used to transfer our surplus beer onto these ships until Saccone and Speed, and they would just transfer the debit to the other ships, and we would take on sherry and a little bit of port. And when we got back to England, we'd do the reverse trade. We'd send that to other ships, and it was most convenient. And also, as we didn't become liable for payment until we consumed it. In the event of our ship being sunk, all the wines and spirits aboard would not be debited to us individually. That would be Zirconian speeds of us. So that was a great service to the Royal Navy. Not that we drank a lot, but it did mean that it was very convenient and very economic for us. So I liked Gibraltar. There's always a lot of ships there. And that's where I saw my first submarine in dry dock. And I went aboard this submarine at the invitation of a petty officer. At that time, I had no intention of joining submarines, but at least I saw